Good evening. Welcome to Conversation if you want to telephone. My name is Allison Mills. I'll be moderating tonight's discussion. We thank you for joining us. If you have a question for Congressman Capuano, just press star 3 to begin that process. At some point later this week, we will post an audio file of tonight's discussion on our website. To access that file or to sign up for Congressman Capuano's electronic newsletter, please visit our website at www.house.gov/Capuano. If you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press star 3 to begin that process. And with that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Congressman Capuano, who would like to make a few opening remarks. Congressman?
Thanks, Allison. I think I'm having a little trouble on my phone. I apologize for that. I'll try to clear that up. I just want to welcome everybody to tonight's conversation. We're going to open it up in a few minutes to any question that anybody has. In the meantime, just as a way of introduction, to catch people up as to what we're doing in Washington. Everybody knows we've finished the health care debate, and we're now trying to slowly but surely implement what we passed. I still believe that what we passed will be good for Massachusetts in the long run and in the short run. I think it'll also be good for the country. What we're working on now is we are currently waiting for the Senate to finalize its debate on financial regulation. The House did that debate in December. Once the Senate finishes, there's no doubt that there will be differences between the two, and we'll have to go to a conference committee to try to work out the differences. We are also working on a campaign finance bill that will hopefully address the Supreme Court decision that allowed corporations to put an unlimited amount of money into various campaigns across this country. We can't stop them from doing that, but we do have several proposals that would try to at least make sure that people know who is putting on ads so that it doesn't come across as simply a group for good government when, in fact, it's really the Exxon Corporation or wherever it might be. We're also trying to make sure that shareholders are the ones that make the decision whether corporations actually get involved in a race or not, as opposed to the faceless corporate bureaucrats across the country. Other than that, we may or may not, and I think that there is a small chance that we will actually take up any serious proposal on immigration reform, though I think we should. I think the political nature of it is probably not conducive to it at the moment. There is also some hope that the Senate can actually finish work on the climate bill. Again, the House bill finished that months ago, and we think that working with the environmental issues and the climate bill is not only good for the environment but also good for the job creation and the future of this country. Those are the major issues that we're working on and that we're watching. Again, as usual, many of these issues are tied up in the Senate, and we have to wait for them to take their action. The House is also working, obviously, on appropriation bills. We do that every year. And trying to deal with the deficit. We're trying to curb some of the spending. I'm hoping that most people have seen that even the Secretary of Defense has called for getting some more limitations and more control over the defense budget. I think that's a great thing. Usually it's people like me and others trying to fight for that. Now that the Secretary of Defense himself is saying it, maybe we'll be able to get some results. We're not going to be able to get everything I want, but I'm hoping we'll be able to get some more thoughtful approach towards budgeting for the Defense Department. And obviously we have a deficit to deal with. I do believe that we should deal with it. We will not deal with it overnight, nor do I think we should. I think that we should do it thoughtfully over a period of time, like anyone would do with their own personal finances, and to slowly begin the process of allowing, number one, getting to a balanced budget, but also having the American people make a decision as to whether they want the programs that we have, and if they do, if they're willing to fund them. If they're not willing to fund them, then we'll have to make some serious cuts, but that'll happen over time. It will not happen overnight, and it will not be a slash-and-burn type of approach. But that's what we're working on, and my hope is we'll be able to get to that in the next several months. And with that, I think I'd like to see if we have anybody on the line who might have any questions.
We do have some questions, and if you are just joining us tonight and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press star 3 to begin that process. And our first question comes from Sam in Cambridge, who would like to talk about public transportation. Sam, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Hi, Congressman Capuano. Thank you for taking the call, and we're big supporters of you over here in Cambridge.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I had a couple of questions about public transportation, and the first is, how can we you know, get some funding potentially from the federal government to be able to extend tea service here in the Boston area. So we've got, a lot of places that are kind of slated for Green Line extension and so forth, places like Union Square, and it would be really great if we could, put some kind of pressure or provide some kind of guidance to Congress to be able to fund more, kind of urban public transportation. And the other part of my question has to do with high-speed rail and how we can possibly get more intercity high-speed rail routes established either here in the East or anywhere in the country.
Right. Let me answer the second one first, the high-speed rail.
Sure.
There's billions of dollars to be put into high-speed rail, mostly through the stimulus bill that we passed last year. That's a good thing. I'm a big advocate of high-speed rail in the right places. A lot of parts of this country want them. The only place that has them right now is Boston to Washington, and that's a misnomer with high speed. It is high speed occasionally. The part of the problem with that route, with the Amtrak route, is number one, it doesn't have a whole lot of support because it's multi-state. It's easier to do it within California, within Florida, or Illinois, other places that are looking at it because it's within one state. When you get to multi-state, that becomes a problem. Number two is because when you do that, you're also dealing with different owners of the lines. It's not all owned by one entity. And so therefore we have a problem with that. We have a problem straightening out some of the parts of the track. But we are still trying to get the Amtrak run. I think the only way that we're really going to be able to make high-speed rail work for the sake of discussion, first of all, we have to put it where it belongs, where it's needed. The Boston to Washington corridor has proven time and time again that it's the highest ridership in the country. And second of all, we have to make sure that it works. If I can get from Boston to New York in a matter of an hour and a half or 2 hours, people will take it, even more than they do now, and it's already doing pretty well. But the problem is getting from Boston to Washington. I have never done that run because it takes too long, especially when I have an option of getting on a plane it only takes me an hour. And we're never going to, obviously you can't compete with an hour, but there's no reason in the world that the Boston to Washington run couldn't be 4 or 5 hours if we really thought about it and really were committed to it. And I would like to see that happen. If that happened, again, more people will take it. The country is kind of beginning that process. We're not as fully committed to it as I think we should be, but we are beginning the process of investing in a high-speed rail. As far as general transit, the federal government is deeply involved with the capital aspects of it, building the lines. Like anything else, we can always do more. There's always more projects than there is money. But the Green Line is moving forward. No matter what anybody else says, I will guarantee you it is moving forward in a reasonable period of time. The biggest problem we have is having the state come up with its matching share. All the states, Massachusetts, no exception, is having their own financial problems, and they're having a hard time coming up with their matched dollars. I mean, it's not all federal money. It's usually anywhere from 50% to 80% federal money, usually close to the 50% range, which means that the state has to come up with their share. But that will happen. I would love to do more of that. I think that the stimulus was short on that kind of commitment. I think those types of construction jobs are easily seen, easily measured, and truly stimulating to the overall economy. Those are good jobs, and they have a lot of spin out. Everybody who works in a construction site has to get their clothes clean, has to eat lunch, and on and on and on. And at the end of it, you have something to show. But we didn't get very much of it for that. And if there is another one, which I don't think there will be, but if there is, there'll be those of us who are pushing for it again. The problem we have is even if we get the capital expenditures done, we have a maintenance problem and we have an operational problem when it comes to transit systems in this area and actually around the country, but particularly in Greater Boston. And there are those of us who are trying to get the federal government to be more involved in those two aspects as well, because I think that mass transit is I think it's the future. I think it's good not just for the people who travel on mass transit, but also for the people who still use highways. The idea is to get more people off those highways, and even if it's not you who gets off the highways, if you get me off those highways, it gives you more ability to travel quickly as well. So the government's doing a fair amount. The federal government's doing a fair amount. We do have some problems with the states around the country meeting their matching requirements. At the same time, just building it is only one part of it. We then have to operate it and we have to maintain it. And I think the federal government can and should be doing a little bit more on that end of it.
If you're just joining us and you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press *3 to begin that process. We're now joined by Nelson from Cambridge with a question about the post office. Nelson, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Nelson. How are you doing?
Oh, good. I'm a longtime supporter of you, and I live in Cambridge, and I actually, this is a personal issue, I had a problem with mail delivery. I have a house with two separate addresses, and I was trying to get the post office to deliver to one address instead of another, and they sort of stonewalled me and decided they weren't going to do it. And I came to your office for help, and I was in touch with Danny Ryan for a while.
Yep.
And Danny Ryan said he promised to help me, but after a while he sort of dropped out of sight, and I got absolutely no help from your office at all in what should have been kind of a simple matter.
Yeah, the post office can be a pain because, you know, the post office is not a federal agency anymore. It's a de facto private agency. They do pretty much what they want. All I can suggest is if you give us a call tomorrow, and we'll see if we can pick up the ball again.
We're now joined by Sam from Cambridge, who has a question about the Supreme Court nominee. Sam, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Hi, Congressman. Wanted to find out how you feel about Elena Kagan.
Well, I mean, I don't know everything about her. I mean, certainly I read the news reports about her, and from what I see, she seems pretty decent. You know, I believe in activist judges. I know that that's the minority view in the world today, but I think that without activist judges, many civil rights and civil liberties never would have been advanced. So I at the same time, I also know that they might have difficulty getting confirmed, so that there's a balance between what you want and what you can get through. I don't know enough about Ms. Kagan to know whether that will succeed. She was appointed Solicitor General several years back and got, I think I read today there was 7 or 8 Republican senators to vote for her, many of whom are still in the Senate. But we'll have to wait and see. For me, the most important thing is to get a judge who is likely, I don't agree with the litmus test, but the concept of having someone who is more likely, who sees the world similarly to me, as close as possible, similarly to people that I represent, and it's somebody who can get appointed, who can get confirmed. I mean, it doesn't do any good to have the perfect person if they can't get confirmation. So from what I've read, the initial stuff seems pretty good, but this is going to play out over the next couple of months, and the truth is that we will all learn more as we move forward.
Jennifer is now joining us with a question about bipartisanship. Jennifer, your question for the congressman?
Yeah, hi. I live in Cambridge, and I think this phone call, computerized, whatever, is a great idea, so thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm guessing that many of us on the line are Democrats, or at least this is a heavily Democratic region. And my question for you, Mike, is what are the practical, personal steps, just one or two, that you can commit to improve bipartisanship? Because my view is unless every single person tries to do at least one small thing, it ain't going to happen.
Right. Well, I want to be careful. Bipartisanship is good, but it is not the reason I sought public office. I sought public office to change the world. And if I can do it in a bipartisan manner, I'm happy to do it. That is the best way to do it. But bipartisanship without improvement in the world is, it might be nice, but it's not worth being involved in politics and government for me. But for me personally, I've always thought that there is nothing wrong with having strong philosophical views on any given issue. But I do think that that requires people to treat others who don't have those same philosophical views with respect. It doesn't mean you have to agree. It doesn't mean you can come to a compromise. It just means you don't need to call people names. I went 8 years under the George Bush administration, and almost every time I was in a public view, someone would call George Bush stupid, and I would generally call them out on it. In the sense, not in a mean way, but just, look, first of all, I've met the man. He's not stupid. Second of all, even if he is stupid, he's the president of the United States. And third of all, if he's stupid, how come he won 2 terms? And what difference does it make whether his intelligence level or anybody else's? Even if people now tell me President Obama is brilliant, my answer is that's very nice, but that's not what my main interest is. My main interest is changing the world, getting health care done, getting us out of Iraq, balancing the budget, and on and on and on. And for me, though intelligence helps, it doesn't help to call people names, good or bad. Characterizations are just really not very helpful. So that being the case, for me, that's the approach I have. I go out of my way to respect people whose views are different than me, and I try to do my best to insist that they respect mine as well. That doesn't mean we're going to agree, and that, so therefore, if the definition of partisanship is that we all sing, you know, hold hands and all of a sudden find some common ground, that is a wonderful thought, but I think that's the wrong measure. I think the real measure is, can you work together in a thoughtful way to try to come find common ground if there is some, and if there isn't some, can you still maintain your respect for each other? If that's the definition of the term, I'm all for it, and I practice it every day. If the definition of the term is that don't do anything unless everybody agrees, I would probably never be able to pass that test, because I think that's an impossible and an irrelevant measure.
If you're just joining us and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Paula, joining us now with a question about Social Security. Paula, your question for Congressman Capuano?
I would like to know when the windfall law is going to change. I'm a paraprofessional in Cambridge. Our pensions are not great. And even though we work usually two jobs, all of us, we can't collect all of our Social Security because of it.
Right. Paula, I don't know. But just for you, first of all, I'll do two things. I want to tell you that I will fall into that category when my time comes to retire. Secondly, I do want to take a minute to explain it to anybody else on the call who might not know what you're talking about. Many years ago, the federal government passed a law that said that public employees in places like the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where there is a separate retirement system that people do not have to pay into Social Security, that when people retire, if they get both, now remember, to get Social Security, you have to work for a number of quarters and have to pay into the system. To get both retirements, you can't do that anymore. You have to then offset the Social Security with whatever you get out of the state pension system, which I think is unfair. You have people like Paula who might be working two jobs simultaneously, and if anybody else works two jobs simultaneously, each of which has a pension system, they get to collect both pensions. Many people will work for a while in the public sector and a while in the private sector. That's my situation. And each time I didn't have a choice. I either paid into Social Security or I paid into the state system. And therefore, why should I have to have one reduced because I qualified for both? But anyway, that's what the problem is. As far as the solution, the problem is that after the law was passed, we are now at the point where it is it would cost billions of dollars to fix it. And so, therefore, it becomes very difficult to do. There's only, I'm not sure the exact number, I think it's 13 states that fall into this category. And so, therefore, it's a minority of states. The problem is that, of course, you got to get a majority vote in the House and you get a majority vote in the Senate. And it's hard to get their attention, number one. Number two is the amounts of money they're involved. If we got our way totally, especially if we got it retroactively, it would really kill the Social Security system, just pure numbers. So for me, I've been trying for years to try to find a compromise that is not the right answer, but at least some answer, so that people in your situation, Paula, and others will at least get something. Thus far, the problem is that some of the advocates don't want to find a compromise. And until I get the advocates of the position to understand, look, we're not going to get what is right and what is the whole thing, but something is better than nothing. Until I get people to work with me, it's all or nothing, and thus far it's been nothing, and I don't see that changing in the near future. But I do want to remind you, Paul, I'm in the exact same situation you are, so I have a personal interest to fix this, not just a philosophical one.
Ann is joining us now with a question about financial regulatory reform. Ann, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Thanks. I want to thank the Congressman for doing this, and my question concerns the regulation being formulated in Congress now to prevent another Wall Street meltdown in the future and to prevent us from being at the mercy of large monopolistic financial institutions. And I'm just wondering what the chances of getting some kind of limitation on the size of banks or financial corporations is, what the likelihood is.
Well, I don't I don't know about that specific aspect. There are many of us who agree with you, and we do have certain rules now that limit some businesses, but some of them find ways around it, and we have to adapt our rules to be able to address those. But I feel pretty comfortable telling you we're going to get some serious regulation of the re-regulation of the financial services world. I feel less comfortable telling you what will specifically be in it because I just don't know. I actually think that the provision you're talking about is important, but it's not the most important part of it. I think there are other things that are more important. However, I do think that right now most of the rules are that most banks are not supposed to have more than 10% of the market. And that's fine until you realize that most of the problems we've had have not been with actual banks that are regulated. Most of the problems we've had have been with the unregulated financial institutions. I mean, Goldman Sachs until recently, I mean, they're a bank now, but not too long ago, when the problems were caused, they were not a bank. They were called an investment bank, but they were not regulated by anybody. So I think that's more of the problem than anything else. So the unregulated financial institutions that have really grown big and large over the last 20 or 30 years, we have to get them to have some degree, and I'm not trying to kill them, I mean, I'm really not at all, but some balanced, thoughtful ability to limit the exposure they create for the rest of the economy. And part of that is not being able to have too much of a slice of the pie. So I don't know about that specific provision, but I feel pretty comfortable thinking that we have a good, very good chance of getting some serious financial reform this year.
Andy is joining us now with a question about the estate tax. Andy, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Hi there, Congressman Capuano. First, congratulations to you and all the others who passed the health care law. It saddens me to hear people say that, you know, the administration hasn't accomplished anything. That was a huge accomplishment. So that's congratulations, not a question. My question is that somebody in the family died recently. I spoke to an attorney just today, and he said, well, federal estate tax law is a real mess right now. Tune in 9 months, and maybe they'll tell us in Washington what the law really means and how that affects people. So my question to you is, what are the prospects for clarifying the estate tax law in a sensible way?
I hate to tell you this, Andy, I don't think they're very good. Because no matter what we do with the estate tax law, unless we repeal it entirely, which I do not favor, there is very little understanding of the complexities of the estate tax law. If you remember, the changes in the estate tax law were part of the Bush tax cuts of several years ago, but the estate tax law has slowly but surely gone away. It's been cut severely, and it goes away, I think it's this year, maybe next year, but then it comes back with a vengeance. And what many of us tried to do was simply increase the exemption years ago to get most people out of it. So we do have to address the issue. I don't know where it's going to go because it's going to be probably part of a much bigger package that will either extend or kill the Bush tax cuts. And it might even be part of another package that has other issues involved with it, too. I will only tell you that from my perspective, with the current budget problems we're having, but more importantly with the current deficit problems we're having, I am not a large advocate of extending the Bush tax cuts. I mean, there are some tax cuts like anything else, some that are fine, that help middle-class people and poorer and lower-end people. But I just don't think this country can afford to lie about it anymore. I voted against them when they were passed. I will probably vote against them again when they're extended. But then again, they might be part of a bigger package, and then maybe I'll vote for the whole package. I don't know yet until we see it. But the estate taxes in specific actually could be dealt with very easily. It is too complicated. It is not necessary to be complicated, even by those of us who think that the concept of estate taxes is something worth having. But the prospects of fixing those complexities, a little touchy, because you get into the weeds in these things and a lot of people lose their nerve and lose their interest. They just want to talk broad brush. I hate taxes, or we need to tax more. And I think both of those answers are wrong. But unfortunately, that's the way politics has been the last several years. And it's an election year, and I think the chances of us getting thoughtful tax policy this year is probably not too high. And I regret saying that. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I think it's you ask an honest question, I'm trying to give an honest answer.
If you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press star 3. Douglas is joining us now with a question about the energy bill. Douglas, your question for the congressman?
Yep. Hi, Congressman Capuano.
Hi.
Michael, with the oil spill in the Gulf highlighting the need for, you know, the energy bill and promoting conservation and energy independence, I was wondering whether there's any thought to raising the federal gas tax by $1 a gallon, and
right,
which would help, you know, reduce oil company profits, so the price of gas would go up much less than that. And
yeah,
you could even have like half the money go back to the states to help out the state budgets.
Well, actually, the gas tax goes into the highway trust fund, then all that money goes back to the states to fix their roads and bridges and transit systems. It goes back to the very first question. I would approve of that, but I will tell you that that would never pass the House, in my opinion, or the Senate. I think that higher gas prices, as long as people get better roads and bridges and transit systems, would be good for the transit system, would be good for the economy, and would be good for the environment. But at the same time, I just don't think it's realistic. I think to think that Congress will pass a dollar increase in the gas tax, I wish it could be, but it's not going to happen. So the Gulf spill, it's going to be very interesting to see. I hope that it can bring us the bill that we passed in the House that has been languishing in the Senate. Senator Kerry has been doing fantastic work trying to get a climate bill through. And a lot of people see this bill as, well, it's just good for the climate change and the environment. And my answer is it is, but it's also a job creation bill, in my opinion, because it will position America to take advantage of the next big thing, which everybody knows this. It's not a secret. It's going to be alternative energy. And the extra added benefit to this is, I have never found anyone who likes sending the trillions of dollars that we send to the very countries that then support the people who are trying to kill us. The best thing we can do to combat terror is to defund them, and the best way we can defund them is to get off of gasoline and to get on to alternative renewable energy sources. It's just so simple, and it just amazes me that so many people miss it. So that, yes, I want to clean the environment, and yes, I want to move ahead, but I want to create new jobs for America, I want to create new technology for America, and I want to stop funding the very people that are trying to kill us. So I hope that the spill will result in it. It's just too early to tell. I know Senator Kerry has been doing fantastic work on it. Ed Markey, my colleague in the House, did great work in the House, but the House passed that bill. And my hope is that the Senate will be able to pass it in just a few months, and we'll be able to get to conference and get something done. I would challenge anyone to stand up and say that they don't want to do alternative energy, that they enjoy sending trillions of dollars overseas to help kill Americans. Anybody who says that should be and would be doomed to defeat at any election I would ever see.
Jack from Cambridge is joining us now with a question about the federal budget. Jack, your question for Congressman Capuano?
You guys are spending money we don't have. When is that going to
stop? hopefully soon, Jack. It's kind of funny. I mean, a lot of people point to a lot of votes that they take and say, this is a vote that I'm proud of, you know, the Iraq war, health care, whatever it might be. There are a lot of them like that. We all have them. But I always point to a vote that we took in late 2002. The question was whether we would keep or stop the PAYGO rules. Those are the rules that help the House and the Senate actually come to a balanced budget and to reduce the deficit for the first time in 60 years. And I was one of only 19 people that voted to keep those rules, and we get rid of them, and the result is a deficit that's beyond comparison. I want to be clear, Jack, that I am a social liberal by any measure of the term that I can think of. It doesn't mean I'm liberal on every issue, but pretty much every. But I'm a fiscal conservative, but I want to be careful how that term is used. To me, that means is, if you want these programs, either the social programs or strong defense or whatever it might be, or good highways, you have to be willing to pay for them. And if you're not willing to pay for them, that's fine, then you can't have the programs. And I think that's fiscal conservatism. We will only spend the amount of money that we have. But I want to be also very clear that when I say I'm a fiscal conservative, I also see exceptions to the rule. One exception is obviously War and Peace. If we're attacked, you have to do what you have to do to defend yourself, World War II being the classic example. I don't think you had to do that in Iraq. I think we should have paid for that, not just borrowed for it. And I think another exception is the economy that we have. I think we had to deal with the current economy in a very strong way that definitely put us into a deficit situation. It's a short-term need, and I think it's an investment in the long term. I think it has proven out. The economy is now stable. It's starting to get a little bit better. I hope it gets better faster like we all do, but I think everybody would agree that the economy is more stable today than it was a year ago. And a lot of that had to do with the stimulus funding and the stabilization of the financial markets that we did. I think that was an emergency. But that doesn't mean that we should continue to tell people you can have everything you want and not have to pay for it. If you want a good transportation system, you have to pay for it. If you want a good healthcare system, you have to pay for it. And if you don't want to pay, I understand that. That's a fair answer. But then you can't have them. And that's a societal question. So I can only tell you that I agree with you. I really think that deficit spending is immoral, absent those exceptions. And it's imperative this country addresses it as soon as we reasonably can. We did it once before. We had a balanced budget. We actually had a surplus give or take the year 2000. I think it was 99 and 2000. I think it was those 2 years. But that's because we had discipline for 10 years beforehand. It didn't happen overnight. It took a long time to get there. And the hole that we are in now will not change overnight. But we have an obligation, in my mind, to begin the process of getting out of the hole. And I think we can. I think we will do it this year.
Louise from Cambridge is joining us now with a question about unemployment. Louise, your question for Congressman Capuano.
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman Capuano, for holding this conference and for your work on campaign finance reform. I have a question about the unemployment extensions. It speaks to your earlier point about the deficit. Are you in favor of supporting the 2-month extensions as an emergency measure?
Very much.
And
so, yes.
What about the extension for people whose unemployment will be running out in a few weeks, because those are not covered, I think, under the previous extension?
I am very much in favor of those. I mean, I don't know anybody who is voluntarily unemployed. And again, in this current market, I consider that an emergency. So, yes, I do think that they should be done. I think that some of that could be done within the current budget. I don't think we have to have all of that as a deficit, nor do I think we should. I want to tie this in a little bit with the previous question I had on the estate tax and the tax extenders. You can't have tax cuts forever when you have things like unemployment insurance that you have to deal with. I know that we have some people that think that unemployment should not be extended. I'm not one of them. I think the people that are trying to get jobs in a 10% unemployment situation, it's not their fault that they can't do it, and it could happen to anyone. I think our society has a moral obligation to take care of as best we can our neighbors and our family members who, you know, just can't find a job in a terrible economy. So, yeah, I'm in favor of it, and, I think that is part of the overall exception. It is an emergency, and it demands our attention.
If you have a question for Congressman Capuano tonight, please press *3. Ellen is joining us now with a question about the war in Afghanistan. Ellen, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Yes, Congressman. I had your son in my class at school at one point.
Yeah.
And I feel very, and I really was very fond of him. And I feel so strongly myself about the length of this Afghanistan war. I'm wondering how you feel as a father and as an American about bringing our soldiers home after such a length of time in that war.
For me, it's not so much the time that I'm focused on. It's about the morality of our actions. I did vote to send troops to Afghanistan. I thought it was the right vote then, and I still think it was the right vote, even in hindsight. But I remember why I voted that way. By the way, I did not vote to send troops to Iraq because I didn't see a threat in Afghanistan, we sent troops there not to bring democracy, not to bring liberalism or anything else there, or to even stop the drug trade. We sent troops to Afghanistan because that's where Al-Qaeda was, and they had just killed 3,000 of our fellow citizens. And the government of Afghanistan at the time was protecting Al-Qaeda. So it was either do nothing or go in and get them. And I supported going in and get them. I thought it was right then, and I still think we did the right thing. However, that is now, what, 10 years ago or 11 years ago. And the answer right now, according to General Jones, who was President Obama's hand-picked military advisor, he says there are fewer than 100 al-Qaeda within Afghanistan. And if that's the case, then we have accomplished our mission, and we should have brought the troops home once we accomplished that mission. If you want to argue me, we should leave troops along the border of Pakistan in order to support the Pakistanis' effort to rout out al-Qaeda that has gone to Pakistan, I can understand that. I could agree with that. But that doesn't mean we have to have troops all throughout Afghanistan trying to bring democracy, trying to bring stabilization to one of the most corrupt governments in the world. I don't understand that. What was the mission? The mission was to get al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. We did it. Al-Qaeda still exists. They're in Pakistan, they're in Somalia, they're in Yemen, and we should absolutely be chasing them around the world and anyone else who wants to kill us. That is self-defense, and I think that is morally worthwhile and morally correct. But the people of Afghanistan didn't do it. The people of Iraq didn't do it. And therefore, I do believe that our military use in Afghanistan has outlived its moral authority, and therefore we should be bringing our troops, most of our troops, home. Again, if there's a plan to use some of them for specific actions to target al-Qaeda, I could understand that. And there is some argument that to do that along the Pakistani border. But right now, there's general stabilization in Afghanistan. I don't think it'll hold. It will work. Nobody can beat our military. It will work as long as we're there. But the minute we withdraw at any time, next week, next year, or 10 years from now, Afghanistan will go right back to what it always was. And I do not think that we can bring democracy as we understand it to that country.
Chris is joining us now with a question about immigration reform. Chris, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Hi, Congressman. I think you're doing a fabulous job. As far as immigration reform goes, do you have a sense of what can happen and what would you like to see happen?
If you're asking what can happen politically this year, I think it's going to be really tough. I mean, it is a very hot-button issue, as everybody can see through the Arizona item. And it's hot-button, and when I say that, it means it's very divisive. I think it'd be very hard to find 60 votes in the Senate for immigration reform of any kind this year. Again, maybe I'm wrong, and I think it's worth pursuing, but I don't want to hold out false hope. If you make me the emperor of the world, I think actually immigration reform is relatively simple. I mean, obviously these things are much more detailed than this, but in general, I start from the premise that immigration has built this country. I know who I am. I'm the descendant of Italian and Irish immigrants, and I have never forgotten that. I'm very proud of my ethnic roots. And so therefore, as far as I'm concerned, this country was built on the backs of immigrants, and it's okay to bring people into this country. And I don't mean everybody, when they think of immigration reform, I don't know, everybody seems to think that every immigrant is working on a farm somewhere. But they tend to forget that Enrico Fermi was not born here, and Albert Einstein was not born here. Some of our best scientists and business leaders in the country were born in other countries. So I think immigration is a good thing. At the same time, we do have to limit immigration, and we have to limit it not because I'm afraid of immigrants or everybody's trying to kill us. I mean, of course nobody wants a terrorist in this country. But we have to limit it for purely economic reasons. If we had no limitation, we would have 10 million immigrants tomorrow who wanted to come to this country. Thank God they want to still come here. But what that would do, that would drive down wages, because now you'd have 20 people for every job instead of what we have now, which is 3 or 4 people for every job. And you'd end up driving down wages. It'd be a race to the bottom, and we would become quickly overnight a third world country, because wages would be so low, you'd kill the middle class. So the reason we have to limit immigration is not for any social reason. It is for economic reasons. And the numbers, we could easily have a panel of experts every year determine that how many immigrants we thought the economy could absorb and what their qualifications would be. And if they were wrong, they could adjust it as the year goes on, or they could adjust it the following year. But that's my general concept. I think immigration is good. I think the policy, if it's based on economic needs of this country, could be thoughtfully, rationally thought out. And that leaves us with only one other question. What do we do with the 12 million or whatever the number is of illegals that are in the country now? And my answer is, look, in a perfect world, of course, maybe you'd make them all go home and go through the process. But that's ridiculous. We're not going to do that. Now, whether we should or we shouldn't, I'll even leave that debate for another time. It really doesn't matter. We're not going to do it. And if we're not going to do it, then let's just get realistic. Let's get honest. And let's find a way for most of these people to get a pathway to citizenship. It's not hard. They're already here. 98% of them are already working. They're already contributing to society. Of course, there are a few criminals amongst them. And like there is with any group, there were some criminal Italians, some criminal Irishmen. Okay, you send them home. But 98% of these people are just hardworking people trying to improve their lives and improve the lives of their children. And my answer is, let's get over it. Let's find a way for them to become citizens and move on. And we also have to strengthen our borders. If our borders stay open, pretty much the way they have been, then we will be right back in the same situation again tomorrow. So I think it's threefold: a thoughtful, forward-looking immigration policy based on economic need, an understanding that the people are here are not going to be kicked out of the country, and so therefore we have to find a way to deal with them here, and a strengthening of the borders. And I really find it strange and troubling that different sides, one side says it's only strong borders, the other side says it's only amnesty for those who are here. My answer is, I think you have to have both, or you do not have a thoughtful policy. I just don't understand why anybody would argue for weak borders. And again, I'm not afraid of immigrants. I don't think people are coming here to blow us. I mean, there are some, don't get me wrong. But that's somebody who's trying to come here to blow us up is going to be able to get to this country, just like every other criminal. But most of the people who are coming to the country illegally are doing it for their own personal economic needs. And I understand that. But we also have to understand that we as a country have to control our borders like everybody else does, and again, mostly for economic reasons. But if you can do those three issues, you'll have a thoughtful policy that will work, that will be humane, and will be good for this country. So that would be my goal. Whether we can get there or not, I think very difficult.
Walter is joining us now with a question about the Middle East. Walter, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Thank you, Congressman. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to participate in this forum. I was also glad to see that you sent a letter of support to the President for his efforts in the Middle East. What
Yes.
more can Congress do to help the President move towards peace in the Middle East?
Well, I would hope that we could stop trying to incite people with choosing the wrong words. There's a lot of people who like to use insightful words. And my argument is, look, there's no question in almost anybody's minds that this country is a long, solid, perfect friend for the state of Israel. But that doesn't mean I have never had a friend in my life who I didn't disagree with on some things. And when you do, you call them on it. So that's part of it. The other part of it is, I think we have to stay there, and we have to be as best a broker we can for peace. We cannot impose peace in the Middle East. It'll never happen. We can only encourage and cajole and push the parties to the table and encourage them to find ways themselves to settle this problem. And then support it. If they can come up with a solution, we should support it. And even if the solution's not going to happen overnight, I don't think anybody's going to wake up tomorrow and all of a sudden, you know, if reading the paper that they came to an agreement. It's going to be incremental, one step at a time. They can agree on one little point here and then one little point there. Each time that happens, we should encourage, not just we, the whole world, but especially the United States, should encourage that to happen. Everybody knows that the differences and the difficulties in the Middle East have kind of caused all kinds of international difficulties that have dragged the United States in and others in as well. If we can solve that problem, or more importantly, if we can encourage the participants to solve it themselves so they simply stop shooting each other, it will be not just good for them, which it would be, but it would be good for us and the rest of the world. So I think that Congress really has to encourage that approach. and stop trying to pound our chest saying that we're friends of one side or the other more than everybody else is friends of one side or the other. Our history is long and thorough. You know, I mean, there's nobody in the world that could doubt that we're a good, solid friend of Israel. Okay, that's wonderful, but I also want peace, and which means that you have to negotiate and you have to encourage and reward negotiations.
Reva is joining us from Cambridge with a question about federal funding and health care. Reva, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Thank you, Congressman, for all that you do. You're just great. And also thank you for funding of the stimulus bill and for your support of health care reform. Really appreciate that. I'm concerned, and I also want to let you know that I support whatever you can do to raise additional revenue. I do believe that we have to pay for our services, and I support whatever you can do. You know, I do think that further taxes on individuals and families that make over $150,000 a year is really warranted, and whatever you can do to support that, I would appreciate that. But I'm really concerned with the decimation of the community mental health systems across the country. And also that funding the mental health systems is a kind of a jobs bill as well. And additional mental health was a little bit left out of the stimulus bill, not completely, but somewhat. And we were all a little bit surprised about that. And anything that you can do to support, I know it's going to be very hard, but to support an additional stimulus bill, to think about the community mental health systems, to remember deinstitutionalization, and whatever we can do to help people with mental illness live successfully in the community with appropriate supports. People should not be ending up as homeless, should not be ending up in the prison system, really could be served well in the community if we can get the support into the states and an additional support for, you know, the mental health block grant funding also would be just great. So do you think there's any possibility of some additional funding in those areas?
I don't know. And we did pass the mental health parity bill this year. I think it was this year, maybe last year. I think it was last year, I'm sorry. But we did pass that, which is a step in the right direction. It basically just tells people that mental health is a health issue. It is mental health, not just mental illness. It's mental health, just like every other health care issue. And I think, not only do I think it's a job issue, honestly, most of the support I have for mental health really, honestly, from my heart, comes as a moral imperative. No one asks to have mental health problems, and no one would wish it on anybody in their family. But it's a reality. And with that reality, I think that is a classic example of society owing something to each other. And that is, in my opinion, it's the basic difference between the two major philosophies of this country, is do you believe you are totally on your own, or do you believe that we all owe each other something? Again, you can debate what. I fall into the latter. I think I owe something to everybody. And it doesn't mean I owe everything. It means that, for instance, people with mental health, I owe them some basic subsistence of life, some dignity in life, not just for them, but also for me. I can't, and it's not just homelessness, it's not just a job. It could happen to anybody. It could happen to any family member, and that being the case. So for me, it's a moral imperative more than it is anything else. I don't know whether we can achieve it because money is tight. Everybody knows that. There are debates about how we're going to spend money, what we're going to cut, how we're going to raise taxes. I won't say that we could target it for mental health, but I will tell you that I try to do everything I can to make sure that mental health does not get left out and that it at least gets treated like any other health care issue that we have, with the respect and the dignity it deserves. And I can only tell you that I will continue to do that. I can't pretend to know whether we'll be successful or not.
Jonathan from Cambridge is joining us now with a question about air. Jonathan, your question for the...
Hi, Congressman. Hey, we live... Good, thanks. We live in Cambridge, and as you're aware, the entire 8th District, which is much of Greater Boston, it's just been getting killed by the noise from the airplanes ever since they built the new runway. And as you know, when they built it, it was on the condition that it wouldn't affect the neighboring communities and areas. And so I wanted to ask what a lot of the neighbors and community are wondering, if you could do one of three things. First of all, as a friend of the president who you supported early on when everyone was still supporting Hillary, you can use your influence to speak to the White House, to talk to the FAA, and tell them that they're just destroying the district, and if they can just send the planes over the ocean, which wouldn't affect anyone, or two, your position, your clout as a senior member on the majority in the House Transportation Committee that oversees the FAA to push them to stop it. Or finally, we know that you're friends with the Speaker of the House who came here to campaign for you, to get her to call the FAA, who I'm sure would be able to get them to move on it, to provide us with some relief, which is really destroying a quality of life in the 8th District.
Right. Well, Jonathan, I can only tell you that I've been working on this issue now since the day I got elected to Congress. I fought the construction of the runway with everything I had, and we ended up losing. We delayed it a couple of years, but I lost it. Without me, there would have been no imposition of any caveats whatsoever on it. And I will tell you that the previous administration, the FAA, was an absolute total waste of time. I have already spoken to the new FAA director, and they are reviewing the matter as to how they can reroute some of these planes. I want to be clear. I mean, the routes go, they actually go over Malden. They don't go over Somerville or Cambridge directly, but we all hear them, and I'm at the top of Winter Hill, and so I get them all the time like everybody else does. At the same time, the planes have always come this way. They just come this way more now than they used to because of the new configuration of the runways. And all I've asked is for them to understand that if there are choices, now you can't always have these choices because of the weather patterns that we have, but when there is a choice, planes should be routed over the ocean at every opportunity, not just here, but I say the same thing about East Boston and Chelsea and other parts of my district that have always had planes. I will tell you that the new director, the new FAA administrator, has told me that he will review the matter. I believe he will. I said, all I want is a dispassionate understanding. I'm not asking for you to even put your thumb on the scale. A dispassionate review of the best way. Are there alternative routes we could use to move as many planes as we can out over the ocean? And we had that discussion a few months ago, if I remember correctly. Remember, the FAA administrator didn't come in for several months, but then I wanted to give him a few months to get settled before I hit him with this. So I don't remember exactly when the conversation was, but it wasn't too long ago. And I want to give him a couple of months to review that, and then I'll make a real judgment as to what the best way is to approach it. Because, again, we all use the airport. The airport is useful. It's valuable. It's not going to move. And we're not going to get rid of all the planes coming off of that particular runway. It's runway 33. But all I want to do is to make sure that no more planes go over any more houses than are necessary. And if that's the case, then we will have to accept whatever it is we get. That is not the case now. There have been judgments made to put these new patterns that were not made before and that are unnecessary, in my opinion. But now I feel comfortable at the moment that they will review the matter. And once we get that result, then we'll have a better understanding as to whether they're committed to it or whether they're just full of baloney like the previous administrator was.
And we've run out of time this evening. We do apologize if we weren't able to get to your question tonight, but you will have an opportunity at the end of this telephone community meeting to leave a voicemail for Congressman Capuano. And at some point later this week, we will be posting an audio file of tonight's telephone meeting on our website at www.house.gov/Capuano. And I'd like to turn the meeting back over to Congressman Capuano for some closing remarks.
Well, thanks, Allison. I want to thank everybody who joined us tonight. I know that some people stay on for a few minutes and some people stay on for the whole hour. Either way, I hope you found the conversation informative and enlightening. I don't expect anyone to agree with me on every issue. That's an impossible goal. But I do hope that people realize that we're working hard on lots of different issues, that we try to be thoughtful and open, and we try to be as helpful as we can to people. And with that, I simply want to say thanks to everybody and to encourage them to go out and vote this fall so that they can have their voice heard in Washington even better. So thanks a lot, and good night to everybody.